All right, so as chair, I awarded myself the last talk of the last session of the meeting. Because when I was a graduate student, at my first SSSA meeting where I presented, I gave the last talk of the last session of the meeting. And I knew how much that stunk. And I didn't want another grad student to go through that. But this is magnitudes of order greater than the number of people I spoke to, which was one at my first talk. On that note, I'm Patrick Drohan, and I will be speaking today about research that I am doing in Pennsylvania that reflects developing ecological site concepts for the Central Appalachians, specifically the North Central Appalachians. And there's a lot of people over the years that have helped me understand some of these concepts and are currently working with me to do this. My grad student, Mike Marzicano, who's working on the project, Dave Klausnitzer with the USD NRCS out of Amherst, Curtis Talbot out of Lincoln, Sky Willis out of Lincoln, Brandon Bestelmeyer, and Jeff Herrick at the Hornada ARS, and Mike Dunaway, who's now with USGS and Moab. And then last would be Doug Merkler in Nevada, who I really learned on the ground how to do this with Patty Nowak. So when I look at this landscape, I see two things: my backgrounds in fisheries and forestry and soils. And so when I see this, I see a differentiation in species across that landscape that as a forester you're taught are due to a variety of factors, everything from soils, topography, landscape, climate, genotypic differences in expression over time that have related to that species differentiation. But then now as a soil scientist, I see more specifically how those factors are much more strongly tied together. And that's why, as someone growing up in an urban environment in New York City, in Newark, New Jersey, I found soil science so intriguing, was because it tied all those things together so quickly for me, and it just made everything else fall into place. And that wouldn't be happening today without the NRCS. And so I'd like to thank especially them for the support with this project, financial and the lab support. If we turn to several of the federal documents that are guiding what an ecological site is, we find a common definition, this one coming from the National Forestry Manual. And essentially, it ties an ecological site to a distinctive kind of land, which is related to the soils, topography, geology, et cetera, that results in distinct plant communities and distinct different amounts of the vegetation in those plant communities. What I'm going to be doing today also is highlighting several key papers for people not familiar with ecological site development that you can use to develop more understanding of these concepts. And one of these is this paper by Mosley et al. 2010, which very nicely outlines a process that I'm going to follow today, where you essentially develop your basic questions about what drives plant community differentiation, do your background research to the region you're working in, and then your field reconnaissance, develop your initial concepts, go out in the field and test those, either accept, reject, and evaluate, and then move on to the next area. The next two papers that I think are key in thinking about this concept would be Mike Dunaway's recent paper in 2010 here discussing soil dynamic properties and mapping of soils in relation to ecological sites, and then Brandon Bestelmeyer's paper in the same issue here outlining ecological sites in the concept of state and transition models. And when I was first introduced to this concept, my understanding came out of this type of research in the Western U.S. where you're using mapping units mapped at an order 3 level, far coarser than anything we have east of the Mississippi. So this, for those of you not familiar, this would be similar to the soil associations map in the middle of the old soil surveys. For each one of your mapping units in this area, you would have a specific ecological site. And that ecological site is a generalization of the different soils across this area that describe key processes and the limitations of what those plant communities are responding to. So it might be a petrocalcic that results in a thin, effective soil depth, or a texture that leads to a droughty condition, or textures that can promote more fertility differences. And then you tie these to your soil survey, you tie these ecological sites to your soil survey, and so they can be used in a relationship which explains not only the differences in soils in that landscape, but why the plant communities have responded specifically over time. So our project that we're working on in the North Central Appalachians is specifically identifying ecological sites in two MLRAs, 127 and 140. We're then deriving state and transition models for these ecosystems, identifying soil dynamic properties that can measure and quantify the changes in these states, and then refining these over time. So these are the two regions we're working in. This is MLRA 127 and MLRA 140 here. The dominant difference between these two is you have unglaciated eastern Allegheny region and then a glaciated Allegheny plateau. Pretty dramatic differences in parent material, origin of that parent material, and a lot of the drainage classes that we find. So typically we find wetter soils in this area, more droughty soils. It's a pretty gross generalization, but it does pretty well describe some of the broad differences. One of the key concepts in thinking about finding a true ecological site, which is representative of the potential maximum of that community in that area, especially in the eastern U.S., is considering whether a reference state even exists. And so we look at this landscape across Pennsylvania now, and we see a landscape that's responded to quite a long time of disturbance by people, going far back through the Native Americans even. And we think of the factors that have led to these specific changes and what we see today in that landscape reflected in the current plant community. We see that in response to the most significant disturbance that occurred in the North Central Appalachians, which would be the industrial development, the clearing of the trees to support the development of railroads and the tanning industry in that area, pretty dramatic changes in forest composition, where we see species that declined dramatically in red here, and others that responded to that change in the forest with the clear cutting, where we see a big increase in their population in the forest. And so if we think of this pre-settlement versus this post-settlement condition and we look at the forest composition today, we wonder what is even the reference state that we're starting with. So typically when we're working in these sites out west, you're looking at a fairly representative undisturbed location. For most parts in the eastern U.S., this no longer exists. And so here's a pretty nice example showing some of this change over time. We have our pre-harvest condition in 1927 before the chemical wood era really took off in this one part of Pennsylvania. This is from the Allegheny National Forest. And we have a composition of a typical black cherry stand mature at this point. This essentially our American beech stand at this point comprised about 50% American beech, sugar maple, and black cherry. This was harvested first for saw timber in 1927. That timber was then used to build most of the superstructure throughout Pennsylvania to move the wood out and the resources that were being mined. And then the industries came back in and removed the small pulpwood and slash for the tanning industry in the state. Over time, the species composition in this area responded. And following 10 years of that clear cutting, we saw a switch from sugar maple beech to domination by black cherry across the area in 1937. By 1947, the area is filling in, and we see shade-tolerant sugar maple moving back in under the understory of the black cherry. By 1958, we see black cherry still dominating and starting to grow significantly larger across the site with sugar maple still present. By 1968, we see a change in that understory composition where some of the species are being weeded out. And by 1978, we see pretty much a stable relationship developing with black cherry, sugar maple, and now some basswood in the stand. By 1989, you have a pretty much dominant black cherry, sugar maple, and basswood stand, which does not change after 1998. And so you see a shift from this early forest condition, pre-European settlement, you could argue, where it was dominated by one species to a shift now to a completely different species. And so this composition is now stable to various degrees across different parts of the Allegheny Plateau. And if we look at this shift between 1927 to 1998, and we look at other examples of black cherry stands across the northern hardwoods part of the Allegheny Plateau, we wonder what exactly is the reference state. Is it the 1927 model? Is it the 1998 model? Is the 1998 model just the state of that original system? And are these two models we have for what a black cherry stand is today with a different understory just states of this original system? The ultimate question, though, is how has the soil changed at all in this area? And is that measurable? And so our goal in working in this project in Pennsylvania is to find the least disturbed conditions that we can. And in some cases, that's impossible. You'll have one of these areas that's evolved back into a site where you have a new dominant stand different from the original. Some key concepts to remember here is that every ecological site is going to be tied to a Sergo mapping unit, but the scale does not have to be equal. So you can have multiple ecological sites in a mapping unit. The aerial extent to define an ecological site is approximately 200 acres that would justify identification and classification of that site. And then you essentially want to have at least 2,000 acres to justify the development of the description and then the following state and transition models. So how did we start doing this in Pennsylvania? We first turned to Bailey's Level 4 ecoregions, which is similar to the MLRA ecoregions we use in Soil Survey, or the USGS ones, or US Forest Service. These provide very nice detailed information about differences in the relief across the area, elevations, the soils in general across that area and their limitations for production, and it gives you a good idea of the natural vegetation that's found in those regions. We next have turned to a very specific site-level stand development document that the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources use for their stand typing. So when they actually go in to cruise a stand of timber, they'll actually will now classify this at a level below an Order 2 soil survey in Pennsylvania. So what we're doing is bringing these two documents together, trying to find where the most appropriate scale is for developing an ecological site. And the problem that we have with the PA-DCNR document, the FIKE manual as it's called, is it's too specific because it's below the level of what you can capture in a typical Order 3 or Order 2 survey. You would have multiple stand types or land type associations within any one mapping unit. And there's very little tying these stand types to specific areas of the landscape. You have to make an assessment based on going out to each one of these areas what the best stand type is. These are broken out across all possible ecological types, so they would work very well for identifying ecological sites. We have wetland, terrestrial herbaceous, woodland, shrubland, and forestland areas. And when we look at these forestland areas, there's subtypes within each one of these classifications. So we have plenty of information here in the vegetative communities. All we have to do now is tie these back to an appropriate scale to be used with the soil survey. So the question is, what scale do we use, though? Again, the goal in Pennsylvania is to develop an Order 2 model. So how did we do this with SIRGO? We first identified patterns independent of SIRGO and STATSCO looking across the landscape. So we have existing soil survey mapping that's complete in Pennsylvania, but doesn't necessarily reflect the plant communities. But using the information in STATSCO or SIRGO, we can identify dominant factors that will result in different vegetative communities, such as drainage clash, depth to restricting layer, or inherent versus dynamic soil properties. Now, the important thing to recognize in this table is that there are different rows and there are different groups of rows. And each one of these represents, for each of the different MLRAs, toposequences. And so we've used a classification system to identify the dominant soils in each of these MLRAs and then subset them based on these toposequences into soils that might be wetter or drier. So the blue dots here would indicate soils we would expect a different ecological site just because of a very poorly drained or somewhat poorly drained drainage class. And then based on the other land type associations that we know would result in different vegetative communities, we use the other soils knowledge to identify soils that were likely to have overlap in the different vegetative communities. And then from here, we come up with a potential model of at least 10 different ecological sites just based on the soil relationships we know occur in this one area of this MLRA. Next, we used the LIDAR data in Pennsylvania to identify specific landscapes where we would expect differences in vegetation and soils. And so we'll use various metrics derived from the GIS analyses to identify landforms where we might have wet soils or potentially wet or dry soils or dry soils completely. And this is just adapted from a simple curvature index, for instance, with this one model. And then we'll derive climate variables for these areas using the MLRA, Climate Regimes Atlas of Pennsylvania, or Atlas and Slope Maps, the typical ones you would use to identify even soil property differences or mapping units across an area. But the problem is, when we use the LIDAR data in Pennsylvania, we can easily map now at an Order 1 level, which would not be the appropriate level for developing these ecological sites in the state. We would have too many individual areas. So we went back to the landscape association, started using topography and scaling down with the LIDAR data to identify unique areas where we had these patterns of topography, curvature, slope, aspect, et cetera, independent of soils, to identify potential areas where we might expect landforms that could result in unique vegetative communities. And so here you see an example of the level 5 ecoregions. So the best scale we have in Pennsylvania for Bailey's is level 4. Missouri has a level 5 they developed independently. And then you can see within this one area of the Bailey's ecoregions, you have a dispersion of different level 5 ecoregions. So then within each one of these level 5 ecoregions, we can now start assigning from the FIKE manual vegetation unique ecological sites that meet the criteria of these landscape positions as identified with the GIS, assign soils to each one of these ecological sites now that generally capture the limitations or suitabilities, and then go to the field to validate these. And so for each of these two ecoregions, 127 and 140, we have 32 level 5 ecoregions developed in 127, 34 developed in 140. When we go down through a classification scheme to give you an idea of the hierarchy, again, you see this topo sequence here related to different elevational gradients unique. So just looking at the patterns across these two MLRAs, we see a distinct difference in elevation with within this one level 5 ecoregion, the landscape elevation at 500, 700 meters. In the second one at the level 5 ecoregion, you're looking at 750 to 850 meters. We have a proportion of soils that make up each of these areas that we know already result in different vegetative communities. And now we start identifying the broad characteristics in these soils that are going to result in limitations for different vegetative communities. And so these areas then become our level 6 or our working ecological sites. And so we then start working with the Fike manual to type these on the ground and collect the plant production data. The next step that we're doing is developing initial state and transition models using the soil dynamic properties. And so each ecological site will have a state and transition model predicting its potential pathways through time. And that's the second major part of our project. This is an example of a state and transition model from out west. We see for each one of these boxes here, we have a typical state. And so this would be essentially our original state, our native undisturbed state. And then we have various pathways that respond to landscape change, whether it's fire or off-road vehicle use, that result in shifts in these plant communities over time. And so by quantifying the degrees of differences between these, we can get an idea of the magnitude of change to bring a site back to its original, or bring a state back to its original condition, perhaps. As an example for Pennsylvania, here we have what we call an unglaciated black cherry site. This would be one of our ecological sites. Again, this is to remind you that it's not a native condition. We do have a difference in the vegetation community, and so we're going with the least disturbed current vegetation type. But we have two different states that are different from the type location, where we have a fern understory, which we know has a distinct geochemical difference. And then we have an understory that's responded differently. The cause for both of these differences from the original native state is simply deer browsing. But why one responds differently with a different vegetative community has to do with the soil properties, the chemistry, and the texture. This is known from the literature in Pennsylvania that the ecologists have developed. So the cause of the differences in the plant communities underneath the same basal area for this black cherry stand is a deer-derived change that has resulted in a soil change that you can measure with pH and texture over time. And the texture argument could be used to even separate these into two different ecological sites, because I question whether this is even a derived difference because of a deer. How could deer bring about a change in texture? So when we start looking at the soil dynamic properties that we can use to measure these differences in these states, we have to remind ourselves what the intention of these are. And so we're looking at change that we can exhibit, or change that we can see in a soil over a human time scale due to natural or anthropogenic disturbance. And two great references to get a little more information about this would be Kathy Siebel's work, Arlene Tugel's work. The nice thing about the soil dynamic properties is they can act as an indicator of an ecological site, but they can also be used to quantify the degree of change on an ecological site and identify a new state. So in some cases, the new states may be subtle. But the question we had was, do the properties that are being used out west on rangelands work in the east? So to give you an example here to address the question of whether we can measure change in these soils across the different states, here we see an example from Scott Bailey's work in northern Pennsylvania with the Forest Service, where they looked at soil chemistry change over 30 years on the Allegheny Plateau. And they compared samples originally collected in 1967 on the x-axis to samples resampled in early 2000 on the y-axis. And the degree of departure here shows you changes in the soil chemistry they attribute to changes in the soil from acid rain leaching. And so we see a drop in soil pH, a drop in calcium, magnesium, with an increase in aluminum. We know that these have caused changes in the Forbes community across the state, and we know we can use this as a way to track changes in ecological sites that have resulted in distinct states. So the question, though, is can we measure these pH magnitude changes in a way across the extensiveness of these areas to actually attribute a difference in a state due to acid deposition? These can be some pretty small changes in soil pH that, with a typical forest understory, which has a large variability in soil properties, you would need a very, very large sample size to actually show a change over time, and whether you could find this across large areas without having these reference samples to compare to from an earlier period is questionable. So can you use this to define a new state as unknown? This is an example of some research that I did with Mark Stolt. Mark had a student, Matt Richardson, who did a study looking at differences on paired sites between forest and agricultural areas in the total amount of carbon versus the amount of carbon in the just the OA and O&A horizon. And what we were doing in this paper was demonstrating that you can use these changes in carbon as a soil dynamic property and show these changes due to land use across the same soil series, and then tie this to the soil survey by developing a new phase concept. We can go out there and we can measure these changes and show there's a change in that landscape that is a new state. So you could argue that that change from a forest to an agricultural site is a different state, or a change in one forest type to another can result in a new state. If we look at our agronomy farm at Penn State and we look at different ecological sites we've developed for this one area, we see four unique ecological sites. But today you have an agricultural state across the lower part and then a recovering forested condition up higher. If we dig soil pits in these areas and look at the soils, we see distinct differences in the morphology. Here you have a topographic wetness map, which shows potential wetness across the sites. You can also think of this as a potential carbon map. So the bluer areas might be areas where you might have higher carbon. And if we look at differences in these soils due to historic land use, we see some key things. In the lower landscape conditions where agricultural erosion has accumulated material, we see a large amount of sediment with a buried A horizon here in these lower landscape positions. As we move up the slopes, we see an area that was once tilled with an old AP layer with a recovering A horizon in the surface. And then up in the forested areas high in the ridge here, we see no evidence of historic agriculture with a typical O and A horizon. So using these differences in soil properties and where the amount of carbon is being stored, we can actually measure differences in states and ecological sites across these areas. And we can quantify this. So here we have three soils on the left that represent the topo sequence from a summit back slope to a foot slope. We have an impoundment created in these areas where we have the same soil here, now flooded. We can measure this change in the amount of soil carbon over time and see that the change in response to this change in land use has a measurable effect across this landscape. So depending on the point of what you're trying to derive this ecological site for in the state and transition model, we're confident that we can quantify that change. So what we're working now on is using O horizon composition or presence or absence, A horizon thickness or the pattern of an A or AP, the whole profile or segmented soil organic carbon content, differences in profiles where you have truncation due to agricultural or logging erosion where you have no original silt loam in our soils in the A horizon and we go right to an A horizon with increased clay, or areas where you have these evidences of buried surfaces. And we're also experimenting with chemistry variables, but the chemistry variables are posing a problem because of their change in rapid response to changing land use or their incredible variability across some of these recovering forested areas. We're finding from our power analyses that we need enormous sample sizes to capture an actual difference in a state. So some conclusions that we've derived is, number one is after you use a Bailey's ecoregion model for your area to find the potential sites, stick with a landform and climate analysis to derive those dominant landforms where you can find these sites. Then you can validate the vegetation and tie this to Sergo directly. We think it's best to think of these areas where you're picking ecological sites as not native, but essentially your least disturbed areas. And the trick is when you're doing this is not to keep splitting out sites. Stick to those constraints set by Curtis with the NRCS there. And those are just guidelines at this point. The other thing to recognize is that your state is likely to have a system they're already using. So Pennsylvania DCNR always has one that they use, and their land type association may be the preferable one to the ecological site. And then the other aspect of what we're concerned about now is this concept of what states can be used or not used for, and we think that right now the thinking of these areas has to be broadened to include agricultural locations in the East, especially since they're so important to changing land use over time. So this is an example of one of our northern hardwood skeletal loamy upland ecological sites with sheep laurel in bloom last spring. Thank you. Janice.
Look at the definition of sites out. with multiple ecological sites.
Right, right. Yeah, so, yes, I agree. Other questions? Dan?
You mentioned that it's difficult to find a good reference site. Have you ever thought about using virgin timber stands?
So let me clarify. I don't think it's hard to find a good site. What's hard to find is a site typical of what I experienced they're using out west. And Janice, maybe you can speak more to that. But it was driven home to me out west that you want to find these undisturbed states. And you just don't find those in the east. And even the virgin timber areas, you could argue, aren't native because Native Americans manage the heck out of those landscapes. And so I think it's okay to not use a virgin area. I don't have a problem with that. You know, it's reflective of a time period, and it's a management principle. So what you're doing is showing, with the state and transition model, departure from that site you've chosen as your reference site.
Yes, so it wouldn't be your reference site, but it could be one of your states in the model to have this native forest that has been purposely not burned, you know, not manipulated by humans. They do that in some of the ecological sites out west. Your reference state is basically what is pre-European civilization, what would be the best conditions, what came back from range sites, best conditions.
But I would argue you'll never have that ever because of climate change. We're already a zone warmer in Pennsylvania. You can grow yucca in Lancaster County now.
Yeah, something that's 350 years old or something like that, it doesn't make any sense because you have acid rain or deposition, nitrogen deposition, increase in temperature, who knows what the precipitation patterns are going to do.
So that was my...
Sorry. There's no sense shooting for something that's, you know, that we had 350 years ago when we'll never go back to that.
Right, so it would not be your reference site. That was my argument.
No, I agree. So we would never have a reference site in Pennsylvania.
No, I think
that's what I said.
Okay.
You would have a reference site, but the reference site should not be the suggestion was using native.
Your reference state would be the black cherry dominated.
Right,
but that's not what was there prior to.
That's the most representative.
Right, that's what I was trying to argue.
The ecosystem that's there, because they're not going to let that. I mean, in some places they'll let that go and go, but what's going to happen is going to be continued to be managed. You know, they'll go in there and take that black cherry off, you know, once it gets so big and some things like that. So that makes, to me, that makes more sense that that's essentially the reference. What's representative on the landscape now?
You look like you wanted to say something. And I want to really understand this, and that may not be understanding your point. So I guess I'm curious for the Western people, does this make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. But okay. Be careful about components that really ecological sites are tied to components within that map unit. And that map unit is going to change depending on the size of the alluvial fan, the complexity of your slope.
Right. So for the students, when you go out west and you look at an Order 3 map, or even an Eastern Soil Association map, you have to be able to identify those series that make up that component. And so you have to go out on the landscape and find those. So what Janice is suggesting and what we've embraced here is that when you develop your mapping component, whether you're going to use Order 2 or Order 3, you may have multiple ecological sites that you have to be able to look at the manual, go into, and say, okay, soil survey tells me in this mapping unit I should be able to find these three ecological sites. Then you have to be able to identify that vegetation community in that mapping unit. And we have to be able to measure that and say 30% of this mapping unit is comprised of a loamy skeletal loamy upland northern hardwood forest. 70% is red maple undergrowth, terrestrial. So it's tricky from that standpoint. Other questions? All right, well. So in conclusion, for those of you not familiar with soil survey research, this is what we do. And I think it's one of the most exciting jobs in the world to have. I love doing it. You don't have to be at a big university to do it. And all you got to do is pick up the phone and call your cooperator, your local soil survey office. And if you haven't done that before, I encourage you to do it. Because working with these people and going back and forth in this manner is one of the most important things you can do right now with the country is helping to protect this important natural resource soil. And that's what this session is about demonstrating today. So thank you for coming and sticking through to the end. Now I can collapse.